Question for you. Would you rather pay $150 a month or $15 a month to work out with the same high-quality gym equipment? At Planet Fitness, you can get top-tier equipment for $15 a month. Plus, save $28 or more when you join now during our Strong Choice Sale. Our weights weigh the same, you just don't pay the same. Enjoy free fitness training and 24-hour access at most clubs, all in the judgment-free zone. Join Planet Fitness today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month, cancel anytime. Deal ends October 10th. See club for details. Question for you. Would you rather pay $150 a month or $15 a month to work out with the same high-quality gym equipment? At Planet Fitness, you can get top-tier equipment for $15 a month. Plus, save $28 or more when you join now during our Strong Choice Sale. Our weights weigh the same, you just don't pay the same. Enjoy free fitness training and 24-hour access at most clubs, all in the judgment-free zone. Join Planet Fitness today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month, cancel anytime. Deal ends October 10th. See club for details.
This is Jessica, and you're listening to the Asian Madness Podcast. What's up, listeners? I am back again with another episode. Trying my best not to skip weeks, and as you know, I'm already not on a weekly podcast schedule, so the guilt is a little strong when I do skip. As you've heard from my most recent episode, I have started releasing the USA Unsolved segments, covering unsolved cases in the USA involving Asians. I know a lot of people within the true crime podcast world cover these kinds of cases, and they are so kind, thoughtful, and very helpful. So this is me contributing by focusing on my Asian brothers and sisters because they exist, and we don't really hear a lot about them. While those segments are meant to be shorter, today's case is actually one I've been meaning to discuss for the past couple of years, as it is a full-length episode, and it kind of ties into my mini project as well. An unsolved case of an Asian woman in the United States, but specifically from the state of Hawaii. What do you think of when people mention Hawaii? Surfing? Beaches? Honeymoon? Poke? Probably things of that nature. Hawaii is known for its gorgeous sunny valleys, luxurious resorts, and fantastic beaches. It has been a tourist spot for decades, even being called the dream holiday destination. I'm sure you've wanted to go too at some point, and yeah, I can see the appeal. It's hard to imagine a sunny, bountiful utopia like that having any trace of evil. But crime does not discriminate. Hawaii is where you're supposed to hang loose and enjoy the good vibes. But apparently, not everyone shares that sentiment. Today's case involves a young woman who one day just vanished, and to this day, no one can really confirm what happened to her, and her body has never even been recovered. It's also a bit of an older case, so please forgive me if I don't have sufficient background information on our victim. But I will do my best, as it would be terrific if this case could eventually be solved. Her name is Diane Suzuki, and she disappeared when she was only 19. Let's begin. Diane Yayoi Suzuki was born on May 14, 1966 in Hawaii. If you can't tell, her and her family are of Japanese descent, and her parents had moved from Japan to Hawaii to start a life in the Aloha state. She had four older sisters, so you could say she was the baby of the family. Diane was described, by everybody, as a happy, enthusiastic young girl with a bright future ahead of her. Not much is really known otherwise about her childhood, but it's probably safe to assume that she had a good childhood, had a great relationship with her family, and had goals in her life. It's really great when I see young people, those in their late teens or up to their mid-20s, know what they want in life, and they actively work to achieve it. There's nothing wrong with just going with the flow either. There's definitely pros and cons for both sides. Diane was an aspiring journalist studying at the University of Hawaii, and she made ends meet by working as a part-time dance instructor and a performer at the Rosalie Woodson Dance Academy. This is amazing, as she had passion for dance and was able to use her passion to earn money to fund her other passion, journalism. Her parents, who had moved from Japan to Hawaii, could not have been more proud of Diane. They showed up for her performances, encouraged her to pursue the career she wanted, and gave her a comfortable, joyful life in beautiful Hawaii. You know those jokes about Asian parents, how they don't say I love you and are never proud of you unless you're a doctor or a lawyer or an engineer? It's generally a joke with some truth to it. So it's really refreshing to hear that Asian parents out there can be proud of their kids who pursue the arts. In other words, Diane had no reason to run away from her own and disappear. In fact, she was loved by everybody who met her, which made the entire situation all the more strange and heartbreaking. So what happened to Diane? On the 6th of July, 1985, a 19-year-old Diane made plans with three of her friends to hang out around the North Shore area of Oahu after her shift at the dance academy. With sand that gleamed in the sunset, framed by trees and the brilliant sea, the shore would indeed be the spot for her to unwind from the stress of her daily life. She would explore the ancient temples, maybe have a cup of coffee while looking out at the sparkling blue ocean, or, you know, swim with her friends. It was paradise on earth, things that many of us can only get when we go on vacation. But those plans did not exactly pan out. Before we continue on, though, it's worth noting that while what happened to Diane is upsetting, it was not altogether surprising for the time. Hawaii had a bit of a crime bubble between 1960 and 2000, and between the mid-1970s to the 1980s, robbery rate had increased over 50% in Hawaii. This was the data that stood out to me. While violent crimes like assault and murder also existed in Hawaii, it was still lower than the national average. Only property crimes such as burglary and theft rose above the national average. The data for rape, though, was very close to the national average, which could be something to think about for Diane's case. This leads me to another series of major crimes during the mid-1980s in Hawaii. The Honolulu Strangler, also known as the Honolulu Rapist. The crimes were heinous, but what's worse is that the perpetrator has never been identified. As you can see, it was already a tense time for the state. But let's look at the timeline of the events. Diane's shift at the academy ended at 3 p.m. that afternoon. Her friends showed up at the building at 3:15 to pick her up, but couldn't seem to find her. They looked around the area, saw that her car was still parked in the lot, so they began to wonder if they had somehow gotten their time mixed up, or if they had miscommunicated. Sure, people had no mobile phones back then, but making plans isn't exactly hard if you set a time and location to meet up. They continued to wait for a little longer, but Diane never showed up. Where was Diane? Since her car was still in the lot, the reasonable answer would be was that she was probably caught up with something in the dance school. So like normal, rational people, they decided to go inside to look for her. They asked around, but no one knew where Diane was at. Once they gained access to the changing rooms at the dance studio, they saw that Diane had left her keys and her purse there. Not only do most people not leave their keys and wallets out in the open, one cannot reasonably go very far without these items. According to those working at the dance studio, the last anyone at Rosalie Woodson saw of her was her entering the hallway leading to the upstairs bathroom. And now their anxiety turned into panic. With no trace of their friend, the group phoned Diane's parents, Masaharu and Yuri. The pair decided to come down to the academy and wait at the parking lot in hopes of seeing their daughter. But as Diane's parents arrived, they immediately witnessed something slightly out of the ordinary and suspicious only due to the circumstances. they saw three people leaving through the academy back doors, carrying a heavy trunk between them and popping it into the trunk of the car before driving off. Was that trunk full of lights and props for the stage? Or something else Masaharu and Yuri didn't want to think about? If you think her parents should have done something on the spot, that's kind of unreasonable. At that point in time, they had no idea what was going on, except for the fact that their daughter was not where she said she would be at. There could be a million different reasons for this, and I fully do not expect her parents to think of worst-case scenarios like, oh, she's obviously lying dead in that trunk. Maybe part of it is rational, part of it is not wanting to think of bad outcomes, because thinking of it makes it seem a bit too real. But after they spoke to Diane's friends and her co-workers at the academy, it was quickly determined that things were in fact not right. It was then that they decided to call the police and reported her as a missing person. Soon, things in the family turned chaotic. Suzanne Suzuki, one of Diane's sisters, decided to take matters into her own hands and became the family spokesperson on this case. She worked with the police as well as the media to provide as much insight as she could to help the investigation. It was undoubtedly hard for her to pull herself together and remain objective and helpful when all she wanted to do was to be with her family and find her sister. News of Diane's sudden disappearance also spread rapidly across the state of Hawaii and became a high-profile case in no time. Everyone wanted updates on the matter. The Honolulu Strangler was already actively killing women, and there were several other unsolved murders in the region. It was incredibly important at the time to try to find Diane, as no body had turned up yet, so it was not impossible that she could be found alive. Getting desperate, the family even printed out over 20,000 flyers advertising a $10,000 reward for anyone who could locate Diane and bring her back home. Though Diane Suzuki herself was nowhere to be found, the police did have one lead, which is to say, one suspect, who could lead them forward on this case. A man by the name of Dewey Hamasaki. Dewey was a photographer who worked at the same academy as Diane. So why did he become a person of interest? First of all, he had quite a reputation for off-putting behavior and a pretty concerning crush on Diane. Diane at the time allegedly had a boyfriend, but it is unclear as to whether Dewey knew this or not. Secondly, on that Saturday afternoon, Dewey was one of the only other person present with her at the studio at the time. Okay, so having a crush on someone is not a crime, and neither is working at the same place. This then leads me to the third point of suspicion. Apparently on the day Diane disappeared, Diane's friends did run into Dewey at the dance studio and had even asked him if he had seen Diane that day, and he had said that he had not seen her. But someone in the group noticed a little cut on his finger, a relatively fresh cut, and asked him about it. Not sure if she was suspicious or just being nice, but he replied that it was from a pair of scissors and the blades had grazed his skin when he tripped. Again, not a crime, but a strange way to cut yourself. If you put together the three points of suspicion listed above, it can start to make him look like a good suspect, except there's one more. Remember Diane's parents saw three people carrying a huge trunk out of the academy and loading it into a car? Well, the strangers Diane's parents saw at the parking lot were not complete strangers after all. Turns out that one of them was actually Dewey. The other two were Dewey's father and sister. Some sources say it was his mother and father, but either way, they were his family members. Once police started looking into Dewey, detectives took in Dewey for an interview just days after Diane's disappearance. They noticed several scratches across his back and his arms, and he also had a cut on his left hand. He claimed that the injuries were from a rooster that attacked him, and as wild as it sounds, he might have been telling the truth. You see, his father owned a farm, specifically a pig farm. It was possible that they had other animals there as well, but we'll talk more about the pig farm later. While talking to the police, Dewey had also agreed to do a polygraph test, which, as most of us know, is generally not admissible in court. I guess polygraphs were seen as more useful back in the day due to limited investigation methods, but with the advancement of science and technology, we rely on other means nowadays. So at the time, I don't believe the polygraph could have been used to prove anyone's guilt, and if anything, they were just used as a, quote, supplementary method, not a substitute for other forms of investigation that may be required under the circumstances, unquote. I bring this up because Dewey seemed to have failed his polygraph test miserably, and even then, the police were unable to keep him or charge him, as they had no evidence, so he had to be let go. There just wasn't enough to hold him.
Shop Macy's VIP sale, going on now. Use your coupon or Macy's card and take an extra 30% off the latest fall trends from designers that rarely go on sale. And save 15% off skincare, makeup, fragrances, and more. Plus, shop fall specials for even more great deals on top brands at Macy's. Savings off regular and already reduced prices. Exclusions apply.
But the family's fears grew by the day. Their clues so far had only led them to dead ends. But the police had one more place to examine, the hallway leading to the bathroom, which some say was the last place anyone saw Diane for the last time. When they did a second sweep of the place, the police found that the bathroom door jamb was broken. When they asked around, the people working at the academy said the lock was just fine a few days ago. This was little to go on with, and there was nothing else noteworthy to look at. Sad to say, the police were not equipped with the tools and technology they have in modern times, so all they could do at the time was temporarily close the case file. Though this case is unresolved, it does not end there. It wasn't until 6 years later, during the early 1990s, that Diane's case was officially reopened and escalated from a missing person to homicide. 6 long years with no new leads, no evidence, and complete silence for Yuri, Masaharu, and Diane's sisters. I cannot imagine having to go through even 1 week or 1 month of not knowing where or what happened to someone close to me, but it is sadly not uncommon for many family members to never find out. But what prompted this case to be reopened? We can thank science and technology for that, and I'm sure many cases around that time were probably reopened because of this new development. The police got their hands on a brand new tool that would make their lives easier. Luminol. Luminol, if you're not familiar, is a chemical used in forensics. It glows blue in the dark when it reacts with iron present in blood, so you can use it to detect the tiniest amount of blood anywhere, even if the surface had been cleaned, and even if it's not visible to the naked eye. To be clear though, luminol can also react with some other oxidizing compounds, which includes urine or saliva. Once luminol is used and a spot lights up, the forensics team is then tasked with identifying if that's blood or something else. In this case, the case of Diane Suzuki, was the first time luminol had ever been used for an investigation in Hawaii. While this is a great step forward for this case, it was, however, quite a disappointing experience. The detectives still had Dewey as a person of interest, and his family owned a pig farm. If anything, it could serve as a great hiding spot for, you know, bodies. But the search warrant for that farm was taking a long time, as it had to go through several approvals. So instead, the police decided to go back to the dance academy first and examine the bathroom. Since that was the last place Diane was seen alive, it made sense. The warrant for the dance studio was obtained quickly, and while it was an exciting moment, things did not go as they had hoped. The old white floor tiles had now been replaced with vinyl. It makes sense. So much time had passed, a place of business upgrading their interior wasn't out of the ordinary. Just when the police were feeling a bit unsure of what to do next, one officer suggested that they could try removing the vinyl and spraying luminol on the floor underneath. If there had been large amounts of blood at some point, blood could have easily seeped into the cracks, right? Especially since tiles tend to have spaces between them. And what this revealed was pretty telling. A checkerboard pattern of blood covered the floor, suggesting that there had been enough blood to pool and seep into the tiles, right down to the hard concrete underneath. And also, someone at some point in time had cleaned up this blood. It wasn't any of the students nor anyone who worked at the academy, because someone surely would have remembered mopping up a lot of blood. Unless, of course, they were lying. It was more likely than not the perpetrator, the one who took Diane. Someone who had planned far enough to know he or she would need cleaning supplies to deal with the spill. This all gave the Suzuki family mixed feelings. On one hand, there was new evidence to reopen Diane's case for real. On the other hand, it was clear that she was hurt before being moved somewhere else, or she could possibly be dead. And now, the contents of Dewey's trunk came into question. The one Diane's parents saw being carried into a car. As mentioned previously, Hawaii was in a crime bubble, and the Diane Suzuki case was not an isolated tragedy. The island saw a surge in crimes during this period, with young women disappearing regularly. The Honolulu Strangler was said to have been active from May of 1985 to April of 1986, so approximately for 1 year. Diane also happened to disappear around the time this person was actively killing women. Could she have been a victim of this person? It was believed that the Honolulu Strangler had killed 5 women total, all between the ages of late teens to mid-30s. One of his known victims was also a woman of Japanese descent. Diane's dance school was in the vicinity of where the perpetrator operated as well. There were various other women who were murdered or disappeared, but were not tied back to the Honolulu Strangler. In other words, it was not the safest place for women at the time. The difference in Diane's case, though, is that her body was not yet found, and without a body, it was difficult to determine, well, anything. If she had been found with her hands tied behind her back and sexually assaulted, her murder could have likely been the work of the Honolulu Strangler. Another difference is that there was actually a pretty good suspect in Diane's case. And yes, Dewey, the photographer with a crush on her, who also happened to be at the dance school when she was there. But is he a murderer? Or just a young man crushing on a woman at the wrong place at the wrong time? Since the dance studio lead kind of led nowhere, the police were now very focused on obtaining the warrant for the Hamasaki family farm. Especially since the farm had a pig pen. It's not unheard of where murderers throw their victims into pig pens so the pigs could help destroy any evidence. But it's been more than 6 years now. What are the odds they could find anything there? The only hindrance was the police captain, who thought it was a bad idea because they had no justification to poke around the Hamasaki farm. It took a few months, but they did end up getting that warrant to search the farm. So the policemen and detectives showed up at the Hamasaki farm with a warrant, and a whole day of thorough searching ensued. One of the officers, for whatever reason, knocked down a banana tree in the yard and dug under the tree. And what did he find? Women's clothing, a leotard, black tights, and a gray sweatshirt. Kind of sounds like the kind of outfit, say, a dancer would be wearing. Not only that, the clothing items were also in Diane's sizes, too. You see, Diane is an extremely petite woman, only 4'11", or just under 150 centimeters. I don't come across women that tiny every single day, so you could definitely see how this became a massive piece of evidence for the police. Unfortunately, they couldn't actually prove that the clothes belonged to Diane, so they had to keep searching, and best case, or worst case scenario, hope to find a body. The police covered more ground and found a section of a rock wall that seemed to have been recently rebuilt, perhaps within the year. Digging under it revealed loosely packed dirt, twigs, and leaves several feet deep. Something interesting to note is that Dewey's dad seemed to be pretty chill when the police began poking around, but as soon as they got to that section of the rock wall, he began to show signs of agitation. The family insisted the wall was decades old, but the findings suggested otherwise. They concluded that the area had been disturbed somewhere between 6 and 9 months ago, and around the same time, news of the police searching the dance studio was leaked to the public. It's pretty clear. The news about the academy being searched, along with the delay in securing the warrant for Dewey's farm, could have given the family enough time to relocate and hide Diane's body. Assuming that they were guilty of killing and hiding her, that is. Dewey's lawyer, Keith Shigatomi, tried to negotiate and lower the potential charges for this case from murder to simply manslaughter, if the suspect were to plead guilty. But the investigators, confident that they were getting closer to the truth, rejected this idea. Why else would the lawyer try to strike such a deal if he didn't think Dewey could be guilty, charged, and convicted? In 1993, the agony of the Suzuki family found a faint glimmer of hope. City prosecutor Keith Kaneshiro, who was also a friend of the Suzuki family, gathered all the evidence and presented it to the Suzukis, hoping to get Dewey charged and put in front of a judge. Everything from suspects to nearly 100 witnesses and any evidence found along the way. The Suzuki family, of course, wanted to take this matter to court. Once Keith presented the mountain of evidence against Dewey and his family, the Suzukis waited with bated breath, hearts heavy with grief. But sadly, justice would not come. In a twist that only deepened their old wounds, the court declared that the evidence was not damning enough and that they were ultimately unable to charge Dewey. I get where they're coming from. Sure, the clothes found under the tree was extremely suspicious, but could they prove that it 100% belonged to Diane? And even if it was hers, did they have proof that Dewey hid them? And as for the wall, the family claimed that the wall had been built years and years ago, when in fact, the police determined it had to be less than a year old. Like, yes, maybe they lied, but could it have been an honest misunderstanding instead? Or maybe they misremembered. What I'm trying to say is, if you want to remain absolutely impartial, none of this may be enough to take Dewey to trial, let alone convict him of the crime. The judge basically did what they thought made the most sense. And that was the end of that. Dewey was never charged, didn't even make it to trial. With nowhere left to go, the Suzuki family gave in and held a funeral for their daughter in the year 1997. It was a ceremony just for closure, but I doubt it did much to ease their suffering. Diane's mother, Yuri, passed away a year after Diane's funeral on December 5, 1998, and her father, Masaharu, followed suit in 2006. But Masaharu, it seems, continued to chase for answers until he died. Wouldn't you do the same? Dewey has since continued on with his photography passion. He even published a Christian-themed photography book with quotes, which is available on Amazon. If you look it up, you will see that there are only a few reviews, and all the one-star reviews basically call him out as the murderer. One review states, quote, "You can't escape, we all know," unquote. Another one says, quote, "One star, photographer is a murderer. Where is Diane Suzuki, Dewey?" Unquote. All these years later, Diane Suzuki's case remains unsolved. And that has inspired the public, years later, to theorize what could have happened to the young dancer. Some believe that Diane might have become a captive of the Honolulu Strangler, who had claimed around 5 victims. Some other witnesses claim Diane was speaking to a man next to a 2-tone Volkswagen, but honestly, that woman could have been anyone, and there was no real proof it was Diane, or that the Volkswagen driver did anything to the woman. These theories, while interesting, don't really hold up against the mountain of evidence presented in court that day by Keith Kaneshiro. And yet, Dewey was still able to walk away from all this. With all that mentioned, Do you believe that Dewey was the person responsible for this crime? And not only that, was his family complicit? It's so strange to think about that. Why would his father and sister go to the dance studio with him that day? Did they know? Or had he called them afterwards, begging for help? I just cannot imagine this being a family affair, like a family outing to go kill a woman who was not interested in their son. It's also worth mentioning that Diane was said to have had a boyfriend at the time, but it's quite possible he was quickly ruled out, as I did not come across any information about him being a person of interest. Either way, Diane's case is wide open, and if you or anyone you know can provide any information, please refer to the number listed in the show notes. So there you have it, the unsolved disappearance of a young woman who left zero clues behind. I guess not zero, but not a lot. I can't help but wonder how quickly this case could have been solved if the police had forensic technology we have today. Of course, hindsight is always 20/20, so there could have been other hurdles. Not only that, though, but simpler things like surveillance cameras could have also been helpful to find Diane or to see what took place that day. Of course, having cameras will not be enough either, because if the quality is crap, then it's just back to square one, like in the case of Noor and Jaslyn. I guess it just goes to show how vital advancements in tech and forensic methods have become in solving crimes. In today's world, we are equipped with surveillance systems and cutting-edge forensic tools, which offers a far greater chance of uncovering the truth and bringing justice to victims like Diane. My heart goes out to the Suzuki family, especially knowing that her parents passed away, never knowing what happened to their daughter. Thank you all for taking the time to listen to this case. Your engagement and interest in these stories not only honor the memories of those affected, but also contribute to a broader awareness and understanding of true crime. Please remember to stay safe and vigilant out there. The world can be quite dark sometimes. Till next time.
Your Honor, I'd like to present to the ladies and gentlemen of the jury with Exhibit B, a bag of Sweet Tango apples.
Mmm, boy, these apples are delicious.
And zesty? Mmm, and sweet.
Best I ever tasted.
Your Honor, I object.
Overruled. Court dismissed. We need to recess to the grocery store for some Sweet Tango apples.
You love a great mystery, but not in the produce aisle. Be sure to reach for Sweet Tango, the most delicious tasting apple money can buy. Investigate where you can get yours at SweetTango.com.